Welcome to the weekly Front Stretch podcast brought to you by FrontStretch.com. I'm your host, Dustin Albino, and today I'm joined by Zach Catanzaretti and Mike Neff, who were both in attendance at Charlotte Motor Speedway this past weekend to start the second round of the playoffs. But first, I want to talk to you guys about DraftKings. As the NASCAR world is in the midst of its playoff stretch, there are plenty of opportunities to jump in on the action with DraftKings. On DraftKings, the objective is simple. You pick six drivers, watch how they perform on Sunday, and if you pick correctly, you can be eligible for massive cash prizes. All you have to do is jump in on the action, sign up through the Front Stretch Podcast article page, make a $5 deposit, and you'll be eligible for a free entry into one of this weekend's contests at Talladega Super Speedway. Once again, DraftKings, where you choose, you play, and you win. Now, guys, like I mentioned, you were both in attendance at Charlotte this past weekend. Martin Truex Jr. picked up his sixth victory of the year and fifth on a mile-and-a-half track. Guys, Zach, I'll start with you on this one. Why is this team so dominant on the 1.5-mile circuits?
I really have no idea. I mean, obviously, we've seen from Toyota and both Kyle and Martin, they've been absolutely spectacular all season. But I know with this win, I mean, I think for the first time, Truex was sort of a surprise winner for me. Like, I obviously expected him to come in and win, but as it was looking like a Harvick type of day. And when it came to Kevin, we haven't really seen much of that pace this year. I mean, you have to go back to Atlanta. The last time, he was really, really, really strong. But him and Chase, you know, they were 1-2 a lot of the day. And I expected it to be a Ford or Chevy win today. And then Truex, you know, he just came up through there, and he got it done somehow. So... And, you know, I felt like that whoever had the clean air, you know, was definitely going to run away with it. And, you know, he had those couple good restarts there at the end, and he was able to get it done again. So it's not always dominating performances from the 78. Sometimes they can actually surprise some people.
Yeah, Mike, what about you? Why is Truex so good at these types of tracks?
I mean, at these types of tracks, in general, I think they have found the combination that fits his driving style the best. I spent a lot of time talking with crew chiefs on Saturday because we got to hang out for 6 hours in the rain at Charlotte, which is a great way to spend a Saturday. But it was interesting talking to some of these guys, especially some of the older guys that have been around the sport for a long time, and to hear them talking about what an incredibly small box they have to work in. It didn't necessarily apply at Charlotte because we've actually got some character back in that track. But at, like, Kansas, a freshly paved track, I was talking to some crew chiefs that told me the amount of travel on the car from least load, which is in, like, the middle of the straightaway, until full load in the corners, is 0.4 inches. 0.4 inches. I mean, there's almost nothing that's adjustable there, so you're dealing with just microns of adjustments on things. And the guys in the 78 have figured it out. And so I think the reason you're seeing this continued dominance is because it's such fine tuning to get to the perfect feel for the driver. The fact that they've got it, they honestly can't lose it until somebody else comes up with something better. So they're just riding this out. As for Charlotte, I think it was a little different than his other mile and a half wins. As Zach mentioned, he's been dominant on mile and a half for most of the year. But this was not really a dominant run. In qualifying, they had a set of tires that he felt like didn't really match up with the car, and that was what they blamed their poor qualifying on. But then when they put the second set on, it was worse instead of better. And they really felt like they were out to lunch. Once they... excuse me. Dang, choke it up. I got it. Once they made their third stop, they were then in the right direction, but they had made some adjustments that kind of put them wrong, so it made it even harder for them to claw back. But if you look at their sequence of pit stops from probably the third pit stop to the end of the race, outside of the last pit stop, because they pitted from the lead, they gained spots every pit stop. And from the like sixth to the last pit stop, they gained 10 spots over that time. And between the amount he made up on Harvick when he ended up taking the lead and just their overall performance on pit road, unlike some of these other races where it was just the car dominating, this was a complete and thorough team effort from beginning to end to get this win.
Yeah, I'm looking at his stats right now, and There's been 30 races this year. He's led laps in 24 of them. I'm looking at the mile and a half specifically, and besides Atlanta, I mean, he's been the king. And like we mentioned, Atlanta was the Kevin Harvick show, despite coming up short. At Las Vegas, he picked up his first victory of the year, Truex we're talking about. He led 150 laps. At Texas, he led 49. You go down to Kansas, he dominated that race, leading 104. Charlotte, 233 at the Coke 600. And that's a year after leading, what, all but five laps.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and then you go down to Kentucky where he dominated, leading 152. You look at all these mile-and-a-half tracks, it's just insane. 77 in Chicago, and then this past weekend, though we didn't think he had the best car, and it looked like Harvick probably should have won, he still had 91 laps. I mean, this team's just in its own area code when it comes to mile-and-a-half specifically, and the scary thing is we got three of them left, one of them being Homestead, which in the past hasn't been his best track. But when you look, I was looking, and 10 of his 13 career victories have come since last year's Coke 600, including the 600, where, like I said, he led all but five laps. So we've all been around the sport for a while. Mike, you've been around it for a while covering it. Zach and I have watched it for a while. Now we're getting into the full journalistic-wise. Did you guys ever think that now that he's more than 10 years into his Cup career, that Truex would be at his peak? Mike, you go.
I don't know that I saw this coming at all. I think this was one of those that you thought Truex was one of those guys that might win a race here and there and would be one of those drivers that would end up 5th to 10th in points. I mean, in all honesty, you pictured Truex being another Jamie McMurray. He occasionally grabs a win, has some runs where he's up front, but in the end, his usual point finish is going to be 5th to 12th. And at the end of his career, you're like, yeah, that guy was a serviceable driver. You know, and he ends up, I don't know, 80th on a career all-time wins list or something. But in the last 2 years, I mean, they've caught lightning in a bottle. They have really come together and gelled as a team. And Martin even mentioned it in post-race. The only thing they've changed has been their crew chief. Ty Barrier decided to move back to North Carolina, and they swapped out Cole Pearn. Everybody else on that team, for the most part, has been there for 3 years. So the piece that changed was Cole Pearn, and between that and their partnership with Gibbs, it has just been a perfect storm that has come together. And, I mean, we've seen it with some other drivers all the way back to the Carl Kiekhafer days back in the 50s, where you just get that combination that works, and they're at the top for 1, 2, 5 years, and then it comes to an end. And we'll see how long this run goes for Truex. But I won't deny, I've been surprised. I never pictured him being a driver that would win five races in a year.
Yeah, for someone like me, like when you look from a fan's point of view, you start watching in the early to mid-2000s, that's just when Mike started going, and he only had one win until 2013. So I grew up not seeing Truex as a winner almost at all. I saw his first win, and then that was it. He was never someone who I personally took serious, and then, hell no. I mean, I did not see him becoming a winning driver. Mike made a good comparison there with McMurray. Besides 2010, he's never really been able to get multiple wins per season and really, you know, be up front more than once a year. So with Truex to come through like this, it's absolutely insane. I mean, everybody in the sport seems to have good stories about him. You know, I know he's a really good guy. He's from New Jersey. I'm from New Jersey, so that's not sneaky to see. But I absolutely did not see. I never saw Martin becoming a championship driver, and I definitely didn't see the 78 becoming a championship team. So seeing those two together, it's pretty remarkable. I didn't see it coming.
Yeah, Zach, I gotta agree with you on that one. I think you hit it spot on with the 78 team, and then Truex. You know, we didn't see them coming, becoming a championship caliber team. But then I look back, let's get personal for a little bit. I've watched this sport since like 1998. I was 3 years old, right? And so Truex in the mid 2000s, when he was in the Xfinity Series, he was dominating in 04 and 05 with DEI. He won the championship. He won six races in those 2 years alone. And then he comes to the Cup Series, had that win at Dover. And then he has that, like you mentioned, he didn't win until 2013. But now, like Mike said, he's at lightning in a bottle, and it's unbelievable how good this team is, and it's kind of scary to, like, how good they could be. Because you look at 2014, his first year with the team, he only had five top 10 finishes the entire year, led one lap. This year he's led 1,977 laps. Like, that's insane. So. Yeah.
And that one lap was at Talladega.
Yeah.
He was a nobody that year.
And really, he didn't have any momentum until the end of the year when I think he had like three or four top tens in the playoffs, which obviously wasn't a part of. But guys, like I said, there's still three races to go on mile and a half. It's pretty safe to say it's scary for the rest of the competition, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, you got to figure he's going to be right there. You got to figure Kyle Busch is going to be there as well, because those two have proven that that's where they can make hay. I mean, Homestead is a little different mile and a half, being an oval rather than a D or quad oval. So that makes it a little bit different, but I'm with you. I mean, it's still the same car. It's still the intermediate car that they have that has been the dominant car of the year. But, and I throw out the but, we've seen this before with Truex, back before he was winning. They always found a way to shoot themselves in the foot. And we've seen it a couple times this year. They've overcome it, but there's been times this year that they've shot themselves in the foot. And I just worry, when the chips are all on the table in Homestead, do we see the pit road speeding penalty or the car falling off the jack or something at that critical moment, and you take this whole season that has been kind of a Martin Truex coronation and you flush it down the toilet because you screw it up at the very end. And the sad thing is, we're not going to know until, you know, 20 laps to go at Homestead.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Like you said, he's had problems in the past, and it just... That's the one thing I like the intensity of this playoff system, but I'm always a traditionalist, and I really like the old points format, where I'm probably in the minority here, where it's like a 36 regular season, winner takes all. And I do like the playoffs.
Oh, I am completely there with you, my friend. I am old school, and I feel like racing is different if it's not a stick and ball sport.
And if you look at that, Truex would be... I don't know how many points that he'd be killing. He's 34 points ahead right now, and that's after one race. So in the playoffs, well, in this round. So I don't know, Zach, what's your take on this?
Oh yeah, for sure. I'm definitely with you guys. You know, when it started coming around, you know, you definitely have your doubts on how it's going to affect the racing. And I think, you know, when you look at it from that standpoint, you know, it's a tough thing to have to swallow. But when it comes to the competition and how stage racing and now the playoffs has helped the competition, I think it's been great. But I am with you guys at some point. You know, I look at what Kyle is now and how this season's been different with the playoff points, and how someone who's been quick all throughout the regular season, they're coming in and they have a little bit of a cushion. If it wasn't for these points, Kyle would be in a much worse position after his bad race at Charlotte. So, I mean, there's positives and negatives. You know, I'm definitely just one of those middle-of-the-road guys. And I know I'm enjoying the competition, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk about Kyle, and I want to hit on a few other drivers, too, before we get going here. But you guys, Zach, you mentioned Kyle and how he had a ton of playoff points coming into the second round of the playoffs, winning the last two races of round one. But on Sunday, oh, my God, he was involved in three separate accidents all by himself. And then after the race... you guys were there. He essentially collapsed. It looked like he fell to the ground. What the hell happened? Now he's only 12 points up, Zach.
Yeah, I don't know what happened. I thought he was dying for one point. I just saw a whole bunch of ambulances in the grass. And I know, like, I went to the medical center, and I walked back, and Timmy Hill went by. The Benedetto, Rudy Barker went wheeling by, going for Ty Dillon. Like, how many drivers are going in there?
There was a lot.
Well, let me ask you, Zach. Let me cut you off. Why? I wasn't there. You guys were. Was it, like, blistering hot? Was it
humidity.
Okay.
Very humid. Yeah, it wasn't quite really heat, but it was just humid. You went out, and you instantly felt sticky with your hands and your face, and you just wanted to just get into a cold bathtub. So when it came to, I mean, that's just me standing there on pit road. I can't imagine being inside one of those cars and going around 190, so I wasn't really surprised. It's a 500-mile race, it even went a little further, so when it came to drivers needing a little bit of oxygen or some fluids after the race, I really wasn't surprised. And you know, when it came to Kyle, him being in that car as damaged as it was, and him knocking down the wall, and I mean, it was remarkable how he finished that race, and seeing him after the race, that just shows how tough it was inside that 18.
Yeah, Mike, what do you think about this? Now he's only 12 points up with two races to go, and we have Talladega this week looming.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple different angles on this thing. First of all, yeah, Kyle luckily has that cushion, and that's one of the things I do like about this new playoffs or new point system is that you are rewarded for the regular season. So he did have a great regular season and a good beginning of the playoffs, so now he's not penalized as bad as you used to be by having such a terrible race. So he has the opportunity to rebound, although we saw it a couple, 3 years ago when he got taken out at Talladega when he was trying to play the smart strategy. So anything can happen. We will obviously see how things play out because not only do we have Talladega, we have Kansas, which is another track that's really not very good for Kyle. So he's got a tough row to hoe right here. I think he'll probably pull it off. As far as the driver fitness, both with Kyle and with everybody, Kyle's was a special situation because when he hit the wall with the right rear, it knocked the crush panel out of the right rear of the car. And what the crush panel does is it seals off between the fender and the firewall and the chassis of the car. So it basically prevents heat and fumes from coming into the greenhouse or into the cockpit. So Luke...
Well,
because that's where your exhaust pipe comes out. So you've got that exhaust pouring out there to the back where you've got that crush panel missing. So you're getting the carbon monoxide going in there and the heat going in. Kyle actually pointed out that under caution, once he came out from his very first pit stops after the incident, he felt like it was 50 degrees warmer in his car, that it was that much hotter. So he had actually told the crew, I was listening to him on Fan Vision, get your Fan Visions because it's a better experience at the track. He had told his crew on Fan Vision to make sure that there was ice bags every time he came into pits. And he told them with like 40 or 60 laps to go that he would need medical attention at the end of the race. And he talked about it after the race once he started feeling better, that growing up in Las Vegas, he knew what heat stroke felt like. And he absolutely felt like he had heat stroke going on. Plus, his CO levels were double digits. But everybody else had the same kind of thing going on. And Jamie McMurray touched on it on pit road after the incident or after the race. He said that the cool boxes or the air conditioning that they have in these cars really does not do well when it's a high humidity situation. They're designed to kind of evaporate or wick off the moisture and the humidity to help cool the air down. And when it's such a humid environment, they really just don't work that well. And he said he felt at the midway point that he was dehydrated and was chasing it the rest of the day. Same thing with DiBenedetto. DiBenedetto said he just felt like he was drained and dehydrated before they got to the halfway point. So I think there was a bunch of them that had that problem, and I think it really spawned from that. I know Ty Dillon's box actually quit working. But the final point I want to make on this, which is the stupidest part of all of it, Jamie McMurray is sitting on the wall, drenched, looking like he's about ready to fall out. And he looks at Matt McCall and says, once I get hydrated, I'm going to jog home.
Wow.
He is 24 miles from the track to his house after running 500 miles at 100 and whatever degrees in his car, and he's going to jog home for 24 miles. That's the most insane thing I heard all weekend.
That's like competing a marathon after racing a marathon, essentially. That's crazy. It was weird because it looked like after the race they were kind of dropping like flies going to get help. We saw Kyle Busch obviously, but then you guys and like on Twitter you saw DiBenedetto, who's one of the most fit drivers in NASCAR, and then Ty Dillon, who's also fit. So it was just, but you said his cool box quit. So yeah, it was just bizarre with how many guys went to the infield care center. Never seen really anything like that. But guys. And it probably didn't make a lot of them happy, which is going to be my transition to Happy Harvick. See what I did there? Now,
nice.
So he saw one slip away at Charlotte. He led 149 laps, winning the first two stages. After having a sluggish round, really, at the first round, crashing out of New Hampshire and having a pit road penalty at Dover. Now, guys, is the 14 back? Mike, I'll start with you.
I would say that I don't even know that they were that gone. They've had speed all year, just not race winning speed. I mean, they've been having quite a few top five finishes and top tens, especially. But yeah, this time around, it looked like they had a little bit more. But Harvick even mentioned it in the car. I want to say it was after the first segment when they talked to him on TV, and he specifically said that he was running a unique line, and he was worried that as the rubber built up, it might hurt him. And I think it ultimately did, whether it was the line or it was just a change in the track, because the track changed for everybody, I think. But I believe it just changed for him, and they didn't keep up with that as well as everybody else did. I think that's why. And you can say he let it slip away. In reality, we didn't have any on-track passes for the lead. So in the greater slip away was probably that pit stop where Truex was able to beat them out and take the lead in the race.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely agree that he didn't really seem to be going anywhere all season, but he seemed like he's had more top 15 runs than he usually does. We're so used to seeing him more in the top five and up there winning races. He's on track to have his least amount of wins since 2012, and that was one of the worst seasons he's had in the last, 10 years or so. So I felt like Sunday was definitely a huge opportunity for him. And also Chase Elliott, we saw him finish second the third time in the last four races. So I guess,
which is impressive.
Yeah, it is impressive.
We talked about him a little earlier, and I don't mind to change the subject, but I mean, Chase, I felt like he was getting lost a little bit. We had these young guys coming up, and Ryan Blaney got the win, and Ricky Stenhouse got his first win, and I feel like Chase was getting lost. But now, as the season's going on and we're into the meat of the playoffs here, Stenhouse and Blaney are kind of to the side, and now Chase is going up. Hasn't got that win yet, but I do see it coming. And for Kevin, I definitely see it pretty similar with Chase. I feel like he's definitely really starting to get those gears grinding. I feel like, with Ford, with Stuart Haas as well, I think they're all doing pretty good. Boyd seems to be a little bit more competitive, and we know Kurt is already out of the playoffs, so I feel like with Kevin, he's getting on his gears at the pretty good point right now.
Yeah, Zach, you brought up Chase Elliott. I want to hit on him before I go to Kevin. Like you mentioned, he finished second, but he finished second in all three stages, which is pretty impressive, too.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of points, and as you, if you look at the point standings, it really plays dividends. I mean, he's in solid position, going to Talladega, which, I mean, that's a crapshoot, and then Kansas, which could be a crapshoot, as we've seen in the past. So I think Chase and the 2014 really put themselves in a good position to get to that round of eight, and they've definitely stepped up their game, more so than Jimmy Johnson, their Hendrick teammate, in the playoffs this year. But when we go back to Harvick, I'm looking at his laps led since he joined Stuart Haas in 2014. He's only led 775 laps this year, which, I mean, it's about his previous low was last year, and it's about double what he has now. So if you put that into perspective, I mean, they have gone to Ford, and they've had to transition to that, which I'm sure, we don't see that. We're not in the race shop. The public eye doesn't see that. But like you said, Zach, he's only got that one victory. So I guess that's why I asked if they're back, because they did show a lot of speed. And then, like at New Hampshire, they were lost. I mean, even before the crash, they were a 15th place car at best. At Dover, they had a pretty quick car, but then had a loose wheel or whatever, and then had a penalty. So I guess it's not correct to say that they're back, but I don't know. He had a good run, and that's what he needs at this point in the season. Now, Mike, you had a hot take on this off the air before we got on the air. I said it looks like Chevrolet and Ford are starting to compete with the Toyota after Toyota started dominating the latter half of the regular season into the playoffs. Now, I mean, are they back? I don't want to say back, but is Toyota not a runaway for the title anymore?
And I've been battling some Twitter trolls over the last few races about this, because you constantly hear these people out. They're giving Toyota all this advantage, all this and all that, and I'm like,
bullshit.
Kyle Larson was leading the points until he had a penalty at one point in the year. He's still right there in the top three. He's been running. He's been winning races. He's been leading laps. The Ford guys struggled a little, but they were still getting top five finishes. I mean, I went back four or five races, and there was all three manufacturers in the top five, I believe, for either four or five consecutive races, basically before the playoffs into the playoffs. So I understand that you've had the domination of Toyota just because Martin Truex and Kyle Busch have been the dominant two vehicles, but Larson has been right there. And as you mentioned, Chase Elliott's been right up in that. So it's hard to say a team or a manufacturer has an advantage when the two other manufacturers are within two spots of them. If you had five races in a row where Toyota's grabbed all five of the top five spots, okay, then we got to talk. But right now, you've got all three manufacturers this weekend were at a point where they could have taken a win in that race. And I just can't see how you could try to say Toyota has that much of an advantage. So it's, yes, they're leading more laps and they're probably still a little bit better, but hey, that happens in racing. Sometimes some guys get it and they're able to take advantage of it for a while. The other teams have to get on the horse and whip it until they get it to get back up there. So Toyota's strong right now, but I don't feel like they have an unfair advantage, and I think you have just as good of a shot of a Ford or a Chevy winning the championship as you do a Toyota.
They have won all four playoff races.
True, with, again, Truex and Kyle, because those have been the two strong cars.
Right.
But I don't believe a Toyota has finished second in, I think it did in one. Did Kyle finish second? No, because he did terrible at Chicago and terrible at Charlotte. So I don't remember if a Toyota has come in second in any of the races, because Chase has finished second in three of them. So who finished second at
New Hampshire?
Loud.
It was Larson.
There you go. So this is a freaking Chevrolet. So it's hard to say that Toyota's got that big of an advantage when Chevy has finished second in all four of the playoff races.
You got it.
I think you've got parity, and many times I feel like we have too much parity in this sport. Hmm.
Zach, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, they're out there. They've won 10 of the last 13 races, but they're not out there that far, I feel like. They obviously, when it comes to a race like Loudon, they let all go one lap. But I definitely agree with Mike that they've kept me on my toes. To me, it's not a Toyota deal because Daniel Suarez and Matt Kenseth and those guys, they're not out there winning every race. It's down to Truex and Kyle. And I feel like Kyle, we've been talking about him for so many years now, is one of the best drivers the sport has ever seen. And I think Truex, he hasn't really never been able to be put into a situation where he's able to showcase his talent. And I think, you know, as we just said with that 78 team, they got everything down pat perfectly. And Truex has all that experience. So I feel like it's the perfect combination with those two. But I really don't see how Harvick, Chase, Larson, and maybe one or two others can't. They've been able to stay close to those guys, I feel like, this season, despite them having, you know, quite a few less wins.
Yeah.
Hey, quick thumbs up to Daniel Suarez, though, this week. You know, he was nowhere all race. And on that last restart, passed like nine cars and ended up in sixth place. It was amazing.
Yeah, I agree. But, Zach, like you said, the last 13 races, Toyota's won 10 of them. And you look at 12 of the last 13, it's either been Larson, which isn't a Toyota, but then Hamlin, Truex, and Kyle. They've all ended up in victory lane for the other 12. So that's, I mean, Mike said there's a lot of parity, and he thinks there's a lot of parity, but the same guys are winning over and over. Do you have a rebuttal to that, Mike?
Do I have a rebuttal? Not really. I mean, they're winning, but they're not dominating outside of Loudon. I mean, Loudon, yeah, for the last 2 years has been a Toyota fest. They have figured that place out.
They've led all but 34 laps there over the past 2 years, four races.
Yeah, I mean, that's been just crazy. But, I mean, the rest of the time you've got the other cars literally right there. And, I mean, let's be realistic. Chase had Dover won. That was complete driver error. If he pulls up in front of Kyle when Kyle's making that run on a backstretch, Kyle has to check up and Chase wins the race. But Chase left in that lane open inexplicably and ended up losing the race. So, yes, Toyota has had the winning cars, but they haven't been winning by laps or, you know, 20 seconds most of the time. They've had a couple there. But most of the time, they've had the other car within car lengths, and it's just been, they've just been executing better than the other teams.
Yeah, I don't really know how to transition into this next subject, but I want to talk a little bit of Xfinity. Now, guys, you were both there on Saturday, like you said. You were enjoying the 6 hours in the rain or however long it was. And Alex Bowman ended the night.
Felt like 2 days.
Yeah, it felt like 2 days.
Like the weekend was over.
Alex Bowman ended up in victory lane, though. It was his first NASCAR win of his career. Guys, what a story. And, Zach, I know, like, earlier in the week, you were at the unveiling of the 2018 Hendrick cars. Big week for Bowman, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, it was awesome. I mean, it came to Saturday and waiting around for so long. I mean, moments like that, I love covering someone's first win. And when it came to a moment like that, it was pretty unexpected. I didn't really expect him to come out as the winner. I was looking at the Pete Penske guys. But, and I know we're going to talk about the Gaughan and Meyer lead battle. I didn't even notice Bowman was leading until a few laps ago. I'm like, holy crap, Bowman's going to win. What an unbelievable week for him. I mean, obviously, we've known he's going to be in the 88 for a while, but just seeing that paint scheme and seeing and just hearing his thoughts that he actually had some ideas that he actually helped design the car and he's going to be driving basically his own car for next year with Nationwide on the side. So that and then him getting the win, I mean, was so massive. I spoke to him in the post-race press conference, and he said that from 2008 to 2013, he won everything that he touched. And then from 2013 to now, he's never won anything. This was his first win in anything since 2012. And, you know, after enough time, you know, you get a little bit older and you start appreciating what you have. So I feel like this win, not only does it put it in everybody's heads that he's a winner, that he can go out there and win, he's not just going to be some guy in the most popular driver's car for next year, that he actually has the potential to go out there and win. So I feel like it was for sure the biggest week of his career.
Yeah, and in the archives, if you go back to this podcast 1 week ago, I called that.
No way.
I did, yep.
Nice.
Mike, what...
Well, you should be proud of that. I was surprised. I'm not going to lie. Not so much that he won, because the 42 is capable of winning. But watching him drive it, and like Zach said, a lot of the focus was on Gaughan and Reed coming down to the end there. But when it came to go time on those late race restarts, a couple of them, Bowman put the car in some pretty precarious spots and made it stick and made passes to take the lead and to win the race. And I was impressed. I didn't know that he had it in him, and it was neat to watch. And as Zach said, it's cool to be around somebody when they win that first race. And I think it was especially cool for Alex, because I think he's taken a lot of heat, and rightfully so, about the fact that you're putting him in the 88 when he hasn't won crap.
Yeah.
And I think it's a valid criticism, and I still think it's a valid criticism. I think he has not done as much as many other drivers who are not getting this shot have done. But when it comes down to it, we're going to see next year if he is a flash in a pan. I think the run he put on at Phoenix really kind of solidified that he had the potential, and I think this proves that he can drive. Now we got to see if he can actually get up on the wheel and get it done at the cup level. But, yeah, it was cool to watch. I enjoyed really watching the racing that he did, because I felt like he had an opportunity. And there weren't going to be many opportunities like this coming down to the end of the season, and he seized it and seized the day.
Yeah, Bowman the Showman, as Dale Jr. calls him, and Alex Bowman told me he hates that name, the nickname. But like you said, Mike, that 42 car, I mean, that's one of the top rides in the Xfinity garage. So I'm not surprised at all, and that's why I picked him. I mean, if you look 2 weeks prior to that, Tyler Reddick, and sure, was a standalone Xfinity race, but he dominated the third stage of that race en route to his first career victory. And then Larson's won three races in that 42 car this year. So, yeah, I'm not I don't think I'm as surprised as you guys are, but when you look at how little, not how little of experience he has, but this year specifically, that was his first race in the Xfinity Series, and he only ran one Camping World Truck Series race in Martinsville, and he finished sixth. So, for not driving anything this year, I think that's pretty damn impressive.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
I put that right up against what Bubba Wallace did at Michigan, him coming back and winning that truck race. And
yeah.
It definitely brought back some of those feelings. So, we've seen some really, really, really strong vibes from guys this year who haven't been in anything all season. So, yeah, those two are some of my top surprise moments this year.
And it was a similar situation. Bubba's sitting there getting a ride. He knows he's not going to have many rides. So, he put that truck in some situations that I think if he was a full-time driver, he wouldn't have done. Same thing with Alex. I think he took some shots because he knew this was a rare chance that he had, and he had a car capable of winning, and he made sure he did it. And I give him credit for it because there's a lot of guys these days that don't drive like that anymore.
Yeah, it's like win or bust kind of, which is probably a good mindset to have. But
checkers or wreckers.
Exactly. Now, Zach, you hit on that we were going to talk about the Ryan Reed-Brendan Gaughan battle. I thought that was one hell of a battle, really, throughout the whole race. Beginning at the beginning of the race when Brendan Gaughan had a bad set of tires, fell back to like 26th, but then rushed to the front. And then he ended up coming up one position short as he was catching Elliott Sadler. Zach, take me through that. What happened?
It was amazing. I was very, very, I mean, when it comes to a format like this, we just talked about the format. I mean, this is what I hope to see. This is what everyone wants to see. This is what this format is supposed to create. And when it came to that 62 catching Sadler, and then you have Brandon Jones catching Ryan Reed.
Yeah.
And they were side by side. I'm like, oh, geez, what's going to happen here? And obviously, the 33 and the 62 are teammates. I mean, it was so much to watch there. And, you know, when it comes down to one point, you start thinking in your head, okay, where was that one point these last couple weeks? And as you've seen from the 62, they've been off tremendously this year. I know it's been a really tough year for Gaughan. You know, and for Reed as well, you know, he started off the year pretty darn good with another win, but you know, for him, he's been a little better, but, you know, at least when it comes to those two, I feel like the better driver did advance, but it was a fun race. I mean, it was so good that it kept my attention off the race lead, so, yeah, those guys were a lot of fun to watch, and as I said, it's something that I always hope to see in this format.
And in hindsight, there was a move, trying to remember, I want to say it was about 15 to go, may have been about 12 to go, where Gaughan was side by side with Reed, may have even inched ahead of him a little bit. They were coming off of turn two, coming up on a lap car. And Gaughan was there. And again, Reed could have backed out of it and been like, you know, let's keep this thing in one piece and not ruin our playoff chances. But instead, he throws that thing into a hole that probably wasn't totally there, goes three wide, almost got back in front of Gaughan, but ultimately that move kept him side by side with Gaughan for about another lap, maybe a lap and a half. And that lap and a half ultimately prevented Gaughan from getting to Sadler.
Yeah.
So you see these weird things play out that, you know, it was a dozen laps from the finish of the race, but that one maneuver probably ultimately got Reed to the next round, and it was because he was driving it like we want to see him drive it on a regular basis. And I was glad to see that he ultimately got rewarded for that.
Yeah, I agree. I kind of stated and how it goes, Zach.
Yeah, one more thing about Gaughan. As we know, he's one of those hard racers. And, you know, you got to love him because, you know, us reporters, we're walking up to him and we're like, did the format screw you? Was the track crapping you? You know, you couldn't drive your car. And Ryan Reed, did he do something bad to you? He's like, no. We just lost it. And, you know, they shook hands after the race, and he's just one of those hard racers, and he just took it on the chin. You know, he just said that he lost it. He had all the opportunity that 16 had, and he just lost it.
Yeah, I think I'll hit on one last one. I think it's kind of ironic it came down to these two, because if you remember back in Chicago, qualifying, Brendan Gaughan ended up in the cockpit of the 16 car because as Brendan was going to make his qualifying lap, Ryan Reed flew around the outside of him on the apron, and Gaughan was not happy. So I think it's just kind of ironic that it came down to these two, and they actually raced clean. So I want to hit on one more cup thing because Mike had a hot take on this earlier and on Twitter. He's had a hot take all week. Mike, tell us about your week on the Twitterverse with the Jimmy Johnson incident, where essentially it should have been a penalty. NASCAR didn't grant them a penalty for pitting the car outside the pit box for having a couple loose lug nuts.
I guess I don't know that we should say it should be a penalty, because apparently it's not a penalty, otherwise they would have called it on. But that said, Jimmy Johnson comes into the pits on, I want to say we had a caution about lap 280. So your, whatever that is, 60 laps from the finish, 55 laps from the finish. It's at that point where, with some cautions and some fuel saving, they can make it to the checkered flag. So they pit, they go to pull out of the pit, and the left front tire changer is short a lug nut. I think it fell off the car. They go tearing out of the pits, and Chad tells Jimmy to stop. Now, this is one of those moments that we are now pinned in this box with because of the rules where a crew chief can actually get suspended because a tire changer doesn't tighten all the lug nuts, which I still think is kind of crazy. But Chad, in his genius way, realizes this at that very moment, stops Jimmy and tells him to back up. And this is where it gets crazy. The tire changer runs out beyond the end of the pits and tightens the lug nut onto the car, and then Jimmy drives off. And everybody who did not have Lowe's on their uniform thought, okay, he's going to have to start tail end of the longest line because he's going to be penalized for either working on a car outside of the box or pit equipment outside of the box, because the air gun went outside of the box as well. They all line up. NASCAR doesn't make a call. Everybody else is like, why is that not a penalty? After the race, they talk to people that are like, why is that not a penalty? Can we find out? Ultimately, a NASCAR spokesperson comes into the media center and says it was not a penalty because it is a safety concern. They started and completed the pit stop. Well, I shouldn't say completed because they didn't have the lug nut on. They started and did their service in the stall and then realized the lug was off when he was out of the stall. So the reattachment of the lug was for safety purposes. And the reason they didn't penalize them was they felt that the stopping and backing up ultimately was enough of a penalty for them that they didn't deserve any more. They also pointed out to us that apparently this call has been going on for 2 years, and that at New Hampshire, the 48 team had the same thing happen, and that is where it happened at New Hampshire, and they didn't get a penalty. So Chad went to the official and asked why they didn't get the penalty, and it was explained to Chad at that time why it wasn't a penalty, which ultimately is why at Charlotte they did what they did and didn't get penalized. So my first take on it is, A, I can't believe this isn't a penalty, but okay. Secondly, the fact that NASCAR tells us they've been calling this for 2 years. There is nothing that goes on in that garage area for 2 weeks that everybody doesn't know about. And post-race, if you talk to anybody else on pit lane, they said that should have been a penalty. So I don't know what calls they've been making for 2 years. Maybe nobody realized they were not making that call. But I find it amazing to believe that for 2 years we've had cars stopping outside of pit boxes and having lug nuts tightened, and nobody has questioned it before now. So I was very blown away by that. But my other beef was, it should have, even if it's not a penalty, it gave them an advantage. Because ultimately, Johnson comes out on the track ahead of 6 lead lap cars. So instead of starting tail end of the longest line, which would have been the lap down cars or behind the lap down cars, and put him way behind, he's not only there, he's not there, he's not at the tail end of the lead lap, he's actually 6 spots forward. And it was ludicrous to me that they're being basically rewarded for making a mistake. And it's weird because there's a lot of rules in the rule book. And most of the crew chiefs don't agree with all of them and how they're applied or how they're enforced. One rule that goes beyond any doubt that you are black and white, there is zero gray area, is pitting in the box. And we have now officially thrown our very own gray area into this rule. And it just boggles my mind that we have gone down this road, and I don't know why we went down this road. But I promise you, having been around this sport long enough, we are going to see teams do things to take advantage of this. And mind you, it's not a performance advantage per se, because you're losing spots if you're having to stop and back up on pit road. But there's going to be some stuff go on here that is going to be full-on shenanigans and is going to end up having all sorts of ramifications. And by the end of Homestead in 2018, this rule will go away and we will be back to pitting in the box.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I can't follow that up. So I'll just call that story time with Mike Neff. So I can't follow that up. I don't think Zach can either. From what he told me earlier, he didn't want to speak after the Johnson thing.
I told him, give him the window and I'll just sit in the passenger seat.
So, guys, we'll go into picks for Talladega. We got the Truck Series, which we haven't talked about at all because they haven't raced. They didn't race this past weekend. So, Zach, who do you got for the Truck Race and then for the Cup Race this weekend in Talladega?
Okay, I know for both, I'm going to try to pick two guys. I'm going to pick one who I think is definitely going to win and then one who I feel like would be a feel-good story and it's not that far out of reach. So, for the Truck Series, I have Grant Infinger. He won the race last year, and when it comes to plate guys, I've always put him, you know, near the top. Even in ARCA, he was good. So I have Infinger winning the trucks, and Justin Haley would be one of those feel-good guys. He only has one super speedway race, and that was ARCA at Talladega, and he won. So I feel like we could be seeing one of those good guys who's able to hone his plate racing skills, but I guess we'll find out this weekend. And then on the Cup side, I have Jamie McMurray. Obviously, he got his last win here back in 2013. Finished second back in May, and to me, you know, he's right up there with Keselowski and Dale Jr. as some of the best, as one of the best plate racing guys. And for my feel good story for the Cup Series, that'd be Brendan Gaughan in that 75. He finished 11th in Daytona 500, top 10 in July, so, and he was up there running in the top 5 at one point in July in Daytona. So I feel like that ECR motor and someone who really knows how to wheel a car, that Brendan Gaughan can come out with a pretty darn good finish this Sunday.
Mike, who do you got trucks and Cup Series this weekend at Talladega?
Wow, Brendan Gaughan, that is way out there on a limb, brother.
Before you go that, Brendan Gaughan, he runs for Mark Beard, right? I was talking to Brendan earlier this year. That's a one-car team, but literally one car. Like, that's it. They don't have anything else. Yeah. So that's old school for you, Mike. Who do you got?
That is rolling some dice right there. Well, I have to pick. Brander at the truck entry list, and wow, you stole my pick on Infinger because he's my buddy, and I was absolutely going to pick him, but I don't want to double up because that would be weak. Man, that would be a really crazy pick. Let's throw that out there. How about the 29 of Chase Briscoe shocking the world as one of the three Fords in the field? Look at Chase Briscoe to throw it up there and get the win for the trucks. On the feel-good side of that, going to be even funner. My man, Myatt Snyder, in Louisiana Hot Sauce Kyle Busch truck. He's not proven anything at the truck level, really. he's new, he's young. I mean, he's cutting his teeth in the sport right now. So you don't really expect that from him. His job is to go out there and get laps and get experience. But I think in that truck, in this situation, he could be the sleeper, and I promise you that'd be a really fun feel-good story. On the Cup side, I can't even believe you left this one here for me. The unquestionable winner of this race will be Dale Earnhardt Jr. in the 88. He will have, I don't even know if they're going to put a plate on the car. They may just have the carburetor on there. But if they put a plate on, the holes are going to be gigantic compared to everybody else. And he is just going to go out there and drive around everybody all day long because this is the last run at Talladega, and they're going to give him the win. Feel-good story beyond that. What the heck? Let's throw out something crazy. Danica Patrick wins in the 10 to go out in style in her last plate race.
That'd be really interesting. I'll start with the trucks. And I'm going to pick John Hunter Nemechek. I think he has to win pretty much to get into the next round of the playoffs. And I picked him for Homestead, to get into Homestead. So I think he's got to win. My feel-good story, I would say Joe, but they're probably going to start in Park. So I'll go with Stuart Friesen. I don't know why, but since joining GMS, obviously, they've performed really, really well. Actually, you know what? Scratch that. Regan Smith's my go.
I almost picked him. That would be a huge deal to see Ricky Benton and the Blacks tire deal get out there. That would be an amazing story.
Last year, Parker Kligerman finished third in that truck at Daytona, so it's nothing that can't happen, you know? So,
yeah.
And then, God, I'm going right off the top of my head for Cup. I'll go. I'd like to see Junior win, obviously, Talladega, and it'd be a cool way for him to kind of exit the Cup Series. But I'm going to go Brad Keselowski. Whenever it's so fun to watch him control the draft out front and then to listen to his spotter, Joey Meyer, connect to him and tell him, like, oh, hi, low, and like, in five cars back, like, what they're doing and how it kind of creates the shift in the draft forward. It's so entertaining, and if you have a fan vision, like Mike said, I highly suggest listening to the 2-channel this weekend.
Or the 88. I have always maintained listening to TJ Majors spot a plate race is like watching Michelangelo work in oil. It is just the most unbelievable thing because he you can close your eyes, not watch the race, and just listen to it. And you can envision five cars in all directions from Junior. The way he just floods him with information is unbelievable.
Yeah, and for my sleeper, you guys could probably be surprised at this because he's had an awful season, but the plate tracks have been really good. Paul Menard, he's had top tens in all three plate races this year. So I think look out for that 27 team this weekend. Mike, hopefully you join us back soon. Zach, I'll see you next weekend as we break down the Talladega race and then preview the final race of round two. It's already here next week at Kansas. And until then, so long.
Deuces.